Before we start the show, I want to address a certain phenomenon. Many of you have asked me to offer a course in podcasting, and so I created one. If you ever have wanted to join the ranks of podcasters, to get your message out there, and to become famous, sign up. The link is in the show notes for this episode and also on the blog post for the episode at ProfessorBuzzkill.com. In addition to my words of wisdom, you'll get individual feedback on your podcast ideas and direct advice about how to make your podcast one of the best out there. Again, just click on the link in the show notes or on the blog post at ProfessorBuzzkill.com. And now on to the show. Buzzkillers, buzzkillers, you know, World War II is such a font of historical myths that we always have to revisit it whenever we can. And we can now because our expert on the 20th century, our expert on foreign affairs, our expert on World War II and the Cold War is with us. Professor Phil Nash, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me again.
Say hello to the buzzkillers out there.
Hello out there, buzzkillers.
We're going to talk today about Hitler's youth. And I was going to call this episode the Hitler Youth episode, but then, of course, that might have different meanings. But we're going to talk about, we want to have a
show. You might attract the wrong audience with that.
That's true. We wanted to look at Hitler as a broad subject anyway, but when you and I started talking about this, we realized, well, you realized more than I did, that there's so much there and there's so many myths about Hitler that seem to have become fact that we really should break it down into three episodes. And so we're going to take his early life today, and then when you come back, we'll do the rise to power, and then after that, we'll do the war period. So this is the Hitler's youth period, but not about the Hitler youth. So let's start off by telling the buzzkillers. Let's remind them if they don't know already. You know, where was he born? When was he born? You know, all that sort of basic stuff, that birth certificate sort of stuff that we all we need to know before we move on.
Sure. Well. Adolf Hitler, born in 1889 in a small town called Braunau am Inn, which was in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which is actually important. So, he's an ethnic German, but he's not born in Germany. He's born essentially right across the river in extreme northern Austria. He grows up in that area. He moves around a lot as a kid, but he grows up in that area. He spends a little bit of time actually in a place called Passau, which is in southern Germany, in Bavaria. Right. And apparently that's where he gets, technically, is where he gets his accent. He has a Bavarian German accent, not an Austrian German accent.
Oh, that's why they said the little Bavarian corporal.
Exactly.
They would have said the little Austrian corporal.
That's right.
Okay, gotcha.
Very good. Yep. Yeah. And growing up in the Austro-Hungarian Empire is important too, because I would argue it makes him even a fiercer German nationalist, because Austro-Hungary was this multi-ethnic declining empire, which a lot of German nationalists were sort of disgusted by. And so they looked to Germany as sort of the real German country.
Right, right.
And not Austria-Hungary. So he actually, he loses, I think, three siblings in infancy.
Three? Wow.
Yeah. So he actually, his father, Alois Hitler, and his mother, Clara Plötzl, I think her last name was, they had six kids, but only three survived.
Oh.
And apparently, I forget, it was Edmund, one of his brothers died very young. And apparently Hitler was quite sort of shattered emotionally by that and sort of, you know, was sort of an outgoing kid and sort of good in school until that happened. And then things went much worse for him. But
They close in age? Do we know anything like that about?
I think they were maybe, I'm trying to think, maybe 5 or 6 years apart.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, one of the myths, and, you know, this raises a broader point about sort of myths in his personal life, and maybe we can rattle some off, because a lot of them are ridiculous, and almost always they're based on virtually nothing. But he had sort of, well, there's sort of, I would call it the myth of the brutal childhood.
Yeah.
His dad was obviously a mean person who was very strict disciplinarian, a lot of conflicts because his dad was a career civil servant. And his dad wanted Hitler, Adolf Hitler, his kid, to grow up to be a career civil servant. Mm-hmm. And Adolf didn't want that at all. He wanted to be an artist.
Right.
And that led
to
a huge amount of conflict. The dad forced him to basically attend a technical high school instead of like a high school for the arts. But there's one of the myths out there is that he was beaten badly as a kid.
By his father.
By his father. And, you know, first of all, even if that were true, it doesn't have much explanatory power, right? There are millions of people out there in history who are beaten by their parents and don't end up mass murderers, right?
Right, right, right.
You know, and like I said, I think that, that leads to a broader point, which is if you focus too much on his biography, you end up exaggerating his importance. We can talk about this in the later episodes. Like, for example, you make it all about Hitler and not so much about his supporters.
Oh, okay.
Or
okay.
Or about the German public, right? In other words, you have to be very careful about people trying to shift all the blame for what happened onto him. Obviously, he deserves a ton of it. Don't get me wrong. But I think in terms of if you over-focus on his biography and sort of alleged quirks in his upbringing or in his personal life story, you feed into that, maybe even unintentionally, you feed into this larger myth that this is all about Hitler and not at all about other people.
Right, right. And right. The Nazis couldn't have done what they eventually did with just one man.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Yeah. Now, you know, by all accounts, his father was a mean person, very strict, disciplinarian, probably beat or whipped his kid, as was typical back then, right? Mm-hmm. Not excusing it, but it was typical back then, but had a very loving relationship with his mother.
Right, right.
And he was also devastated when he was 18 in 1907. She died a horrible death of breast cancer.
Oh.
And he was also obviously wrecked by that. But he was not a very good student. He didn't, you know, the European school system is different from ours. Mm-hmm. You know, they break it up. So he basically finished school when he was 16 and didn't go on to the sort of higher high school, didn't go to the gymnasium. But pretty much an indifferent student. His dream, as I mentioned, was to become an artist. And it is a pretty important turning point in his life when in 1907, 1908, he's twice rejected for admission to the Vienna Art School. I forget its exact name. But he wanted to be an artist, and he applied for admission and was turned down.
Yeah.
And after that, he enters this period of his life where he's...
And by the way, we should remind the Buzzkills that Vienna is not exactly an artistic backwater at this stage.
No,
it's one of the three or four best places in Europe.
Right. Although he is not at all, in fact, he's sort of repulsed by sort of modern art. And, you know, the sort of trends you're talking about. He was very old school. And if you look on, by the way, online, you can see all sorts of his paintings. He did a lot of watercolors for several years. He supported himself in part by... painting postcards of sort of old buildings and famous buildings in Vienna selling them for pennies. And he would spend most of his time doing that, you know, and he's not without talent. If you look at some of his paintings, he cannot paint people to save his life.
Yeah. Right.
And actually I forget which painting it is, but there, I saw one online, which was sort of singled out for like, everything was wrong about it. I mean, from like painting 101 standpoint,
right.
It's like and in fairness, he didn't have any formal instruction.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and I think the art school, when they rejected him, said that maybe he should consider architecture school.
Oh.
Because, you know, and you look, he does have some sort of architectural talent. The problem is he didn't go to the gymnasium. He didn't have enough sort of the prerequisite education to be admitted to an architecture school.
Yeah, and as you say, the Europeans, especially at that time, streamed students off very early.
Exactly, you know, if you
started to show talent late, it was often too late.
And so then there's this period between about 1908 and 1914 when he's just getting by, sort of painting these pictures. There's a point in 1909, 1910 when he's basically penniless. And he's living in sort of men's hostels. This period of his poverty, by the way, has also been exaggerated. He exaggerates it in Mein Kampf. I think it's part of the sort of Hitler myth that he sort of came from nothing.
Yeah.
He did have sources of income. He had received some money because he was an orphan after his dad died and after his mother died. I think he got some of his father's pension money. So there's a lot of exaggeration out there about how poor he was and for how long. But it is pretty clear that in this period he has no future. I mean, he has no expectation of a real career, no direction in his life. And that's one of the reasons why World War One is so important in his biography.
Okay, because that certainly provides – going into the army provides direction provides structure.
Structure, yes. Yes, Adolf needed structure. Yeah, well, and also more importantly, and it's not an exaggeration, gives meaning to his life for the first time. from his own standpoint.
Okay. Okay.
So what's interesting about that is that he, when the war breaks out in August 1914, he is not in Vienna. He has since moved to Munich, in sort of the capital of Bavaria. And he had done that the previous year, 1913, to dodge the draft. That was the main reason he fled. The Austro-Hungarian Empire, their authorities were looking for him.
Oh, right. Hitler on the lam.
Or Hitler on the lam. Yeah, you know, not something he's going to talk a lot about in Mein Kampf about.
No,
but he... He basically saves himself by enlisting in the Bavarian army when the war breaks out.
Okay.
And basically, that's when the Austro-Hungarians basically said, okay, well, since he's fighting for the cause, we'll sort of back off.
Yeah, but one goes another.
Yeah, so they were still pursuing him. But really, he's in these years before 1914, the sort of outlines of his worldview are pretty clear. On the one hand, intense German nationalism.
Yeah.
And on the other, anti-Semitism.
Uh-huh.
Now here, I wouldn't call it a myth so much, but in Mein Kampf, he implies that the version of anti-Semitism in his belief system that we're all familiar with, implies that he had that early on.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Not really clear. People like Ian Kershaw, I think some of the latest biographers, they all agree that the anti-Semitism is going to lead to the Holocaust.
Right.
And then that sort of fires him up. That is a post-World War I thing, not a pre-World War I thing.
Okay, okay.
I mean, it's certainly true. You know, he forms these sort of rough political views in places like Vienna, which, you know, among German nationalists in Vienna, it was sort of the center of anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. You had a deeply anti-Semitic mayor and other politicians. The nationalist newspapers were deeply anti-Semitic, and he absorbed a lot of that. It's pretty clear. Anyway, so I think those are the sort of the two pillars of his worldview, is the nationalism and the anti-Semitism. You see those before World War I. Anyway, so he joins the 16th Bavarian Reserve Infantry Regiment, and he goes to the Western Front, where he spends essentially the entire war, except for the breaks where he's wounded. In here, there's also a little bit of myth-making. In Mein Kampf, he portrays himself as sort of a Frontkämpfer, sort of a frontline soldier.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but he was what's called a Meldegänger. He was a message runner.
Oh, right.
Because, you know, especially in trench warfare on the Western Front, you have various lines of trenches, and often communication is extremely unreliable. And so they rely on foot messengers to run messengers back and forth. He was a regimental headquarters runner.
Okay.
So he would run messages from, say, regimental headquarters to battalion headquarters. So he's not in the front line sort of
getting fired at every day. Yeah.
He's not even running between like the first and the second trench, but more like between the third and fourth trench.
Oh, okay.
Okay. But having said that, it was certainly risky. He was wounded twice, I believe. He took some shrapnel in the thigh. He was hospitalized twice. At the very end of the war, he was blinded in a gas attack. And when Germany surrenders, he's actually in a hospital, sort of a military hospital. He was certainly competent at his job and certainly brave enough, but he was also routinely passed over for promotion. And that's actually saying something, because of the rate of loss over the years in that sort of unit. Someone like him normally would have been at least promoted to a non-commissioned officer, like a sergeant.
Right.
He never rose above a corporal. And it's pretty clear that a lot of his superiors, you know, they trusted him, they relied on him, but they didn't think he had sort of leadership qualities.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting.
Yes, that's
interesting. Considering what happens later on.
Yeah.
But he's twice decorated with the Iron Cross.
Oh, twice.
You get the second class and then first class.
Gotcha.
And that not everyone got those. In fact, for the first class promotion was recommended by a lieutenant in his unit who was Jewish.
Hmm.
Also ironic, considering future events. But he was also, he was sort of an outcast in his unit.
Right.
He didn't sort of, you know, a lot of his fellow soldiers liked him well enough, but he was sort of odd and he sort of kept to himself and, like, for example, wasn't interested in women the way they were.
Mm-hmm.
He was almost like the super serious nationalist. Like, you know, soldiers in all armies in all wars, at some point, if you're in combat long enough, you start to gripe Right. You complain about your officers. Maybe you make jokes about the cause.
Or the conditions.
Or the conditions. And he's the one who would say, you know, shut up. You know, like, how dare you say that about Germany, right?
Yeah.
So, like, you know, the guy who, like, takes himself too seriously and is the true believer, in other words.
Right, right, right.
And sort of stands out that way.
And is often sort of kept on the margins because he's too strong in that.
That's, you know, right.
If you don't join in the griping, you're not joining That's in with right. the buddies, right?
That's right. Yeah. You know, and he did have some, you know, there were some people who in his units who sort of became followers of his after the war when he was a politician. Mm-hmm. And some of them even got jobs in the Nazi party. But yeah, he was not the most popular guy in the unit. And by the way, if you go online, there are all sorts of pictures of him from World War I
right.
available. But it's really hard to exaggerate the importance of World War I in his biography.
Okay.
It really does. It's the turning point in his life, not only right. him taking part in it, but the fact that Germany loses.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is when Germany surrenders in November 1918, he is shattered.
Right.
Because Germany is really a cause like no other in his life. He devoted years. You know, but he was 25 when the yeah. war broke out. He was not a totally young person.
And but, we should also remember that, you know, World War II hasn't happened yet, and no one knows that World War II is going to happen, which World War II is the biggest thing in
exactly.
modern history. But until that happens, World War One yep. was the biggest yes. thing in modern history.
They called it the Great War for
right.
a reason.
And, yeah. and you know, all sorts of, you know, yep. hand-wringing and all kinds of things, emotional reaction to the war is very, very, yeah. very strong yeah. before, during, and after.
Absolutely. And they so. Viewed it as a clash of civilizations.
Right.
You know, the German civilization is on the line. And when you devote yourself to a cause like that, and in yeah. your view, sacrifice so much, and then you lose, that's like the most traumatic thing in your life. And so that... not only the trauma of losing, but his belief that Germany didn't really lose.
Okay.
But here's the Dolchstoßlegende, the stab in the back
myth. Yeah, right.
And Hitler's one of those German nationalists who, after the war, routinely refers to the November criminals.
Okay.
Which is to say the German civilian government
right.
that was put in charge right at the very end of the war, basically because the German generals were cowards and didn't want to take the rap for Germany's defeat.
Okay.
They knowingly hand off to this sort of pasted together civilian government, which, and then it surrendered, and it's the government that signs the Versailles Treaty
okay.
in June 1919, where Germany, you know, suffers such serious losses.
And that's the group that's seen as stabbing
exactly.
Germany in the back.
Right. And, you know, context is important because your average soldier and certainly your average civilian has strict military censorship.
Yeah.
The German public and German regular soldiers were not kept informed about how Germany truly was losing on the battlefield,
right,
fair
right,
and square.
Right. Yeah.
What they knew is the German forces were still occupying France and Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden they give up. Yeah. And so if you're a hyper-German nationalist, you very quickly convince yourselves that we didn't lose fair and square. Then, you know, by the way, you see the equivalent in other countries like the United States. In other words, we could never lose a war fair and square.
Right.
We could only have been defeated by traitors.
Right.
I.e. these civilians, the so-called November criminals, who sold us out, who, you know, handed us over to the Allies even though we hadn't lost. And by the way, the civilian government included some Jews. So there's that, and there's also this other thing going on at the same time, which often gets lost in this, is that, one, the Bolshevik Revolution takes place in Russia.
Right.
1917.
Just as the war's ending.
First time in human history, not only a country, but a big country falls to communist rule, which right after World War One shows signs that it's going to spread.
Yeah.
Hungary was under communist rule for 6 months in early 1919. There are communist uprisings in Germany, including in Berlin. And important for our purposes is the one in Munich. The so-called Räterepublik, sort of the Republic of Councils. You had, in effect, communist rule in Bavaria early in 1919. It didn't last very long. It was only really in charge for a few weeks when it was crushed by sort of right-wing, the Freikorps, the paramilitary units.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason why after World War One, southern Germany, Bavaria, is such a hotbed of ultra-right-wing nationalism is because they had this brief experience with sort of the threat of communism.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're right.
And that really fires up people like Adolf Hitler.
And how much was the fact that Marx was a Jew or had Jewish background, how much did that sort of add to the fervor?
A little bit. I mean, I think you would have had the fervor anyway.
Okay, okay.
But you're absolutely right. When if you're an anti-Semite and a hardcore German nationalist, you clutch at straws. You exaggerate every little thing like that. And
whereas Marx, by the time he'd been grown up, was an atheist.
Yeah, exactly.
He wasn't religious at all.
The most non-Jewish Jew in probably history. But keep in mind also that the Bolshevik Revolution attracted more than its share of Jewish politicians because the communists in Russia were one of the few parties that didn't discriminate against Jews.
Right, and so there'd be a long history of that in
Russia. So people like Trotsky and others were sort of, not Trotsky was also an atheist, but sort of raised Jewish.
Sure, yeah. Yeah.
And so this is a pillar of sort of not Hitler and Nazis and Hitler's and Nazi thought is this the idea of a Judeo-Bolshevik threat.
Right.
In other words, the Jewish threat and the communist threat are conflated. By the way, people should never look for coherence in Nazi thought because let's keep in mind here that the Jews are they're the ones who bring us communism and they're also greedy capitalists.
Right. The greedy capitalists in Germany, but they're communists
everywhere
else.
Exactly. Right. It's like really odd that they can be sort of the multi-purpose scapegoat. But in through World War II, pillar of Nazi thought is this Judeo-Bolshevik threat.
Yeah, and they talk about that when in the invasion of Russia.
Absolutely.
You're going to be running into a lot of Soviets, and they're Bolsheviks, and they're basically Jews as well, so go ahead and
tease the Wehrmacht episode.
But the
Wehrmacht is going to act in the Soviet Union in an incomparably vicious way.
Right.
Because of this idea of a Judeo-Bolshevik threat. In any case, Hitler is still in the army after the end of World War I. And he's kept on by the army basically to keep tabs on political groups. He's essentially a spy.
Even though they thought of him as a kind of, you know, he's okay as a corporal,
But I guess
the ideological fervor he had, they must have seen usefulness in that.
And very quickly they discover in some sort of small meetings that he has speaking ability. There's that as well. They I think some of them see him as sort of as a recruiter because he has, as he quickly discovers, that's the sort of one talent he has is his ability to communicate verbally. But in any case, this is important because this is how he discovers what was just called the German Workers' Party at the time.
Right.
He's hired basically to attend their meetings and keep tabs on them and report back on what's going on in these meetings. Well, that's going to become the National Socialist German Workers' Party shortly thereafter, and Hitler's going to take it over.
Yep.
Leaves the army and decides to enter politics. And it's once again, it's clear he's motivated by, a desire for revenge. He wants to make right the devastating loss of World War I. He wants to go after the November criminals, right? These sort of weasels, as they would have said, you know, these sort of spineless civilians, Jews, right? These people who basically did their best to destroy this country. We're going to get them.
And that shows why. That shows how strong the stab in the back myth was, because that's who he wants to go after. He doesn't want to go after the French. He doesn't want to go after
exactly. I mean, those are the enemies who are going to do the enemy thing. But, you know, the more important enemy is here at home. That's absolutely essential to that sort of concept. And, you know, the sense, not just a sense of loss, but a sense of having been betrayed, which is a much more sort of powerful set of emotions.
Yeah, I suppose it is. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Because you don't expect it. If you're such a German nationalist, you don't expect Germans to stab other Germans in the
back.
That whole sort of constant repetition.
Well, and also just the sense that we are invincible.
Yeah.
But still, we lost because of traitors.
Yeah.
I mean, that's gonna motivate you much more, sort of for payback than just having been defeated fair and square on the battlefield.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
Right. If you defeated fair and square, and it's like, okay, well, we've got to build up our army again.
You can figure that out. You can sort of see that happening.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Whereas in this case, it's like, well, if we have to root out the traitors, and of course, who constitutes a traitor? That's a circle that just grows and grows and grows. And, you know, it's very amorphous. And, you know, and it quickly comes to include anyone who doesn't agree with you.
Right.
Right. Anyway, so he sort of dives into this post-war environment in Munich, which is, like I said, this hotbed of ultra-nationalist activity. There's all sorts of paramilitary units, all sorts of armed political groups, sort of vying for competition. If you look at Mein Kampf, which he writes in 1924-25, he spends a lot of time going after other people on the right, not just the people you would expect, like Jews and communists. you know, because he's trying to carve out some space for himself, but quickly gathers a large following, some extremely devoted followers, because he's a very inspirational speaker. You can find all sorts of evidence that people out there who are not just sort of inspired by him, but like if your glance meets his, mm-hmm. you're almost like swept off your feet. Because of his piercing blue eyes.
Oh, so that's actually true.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No. I've seen evidence in writing, and also I've seen videos where they interview people, and this is also amazing. There's this, I don't know if people can get their hands on, this excellent video series that the BBC did in the late 1990s called Hitler, A Warning from History.
Oh, yes. I remember that.
I show a lot of that in class. It's terrific. And they interview people who had been members of the Nazi Party, and this is in like the 1990s when they're being interviewed. They know how the story ends. Right.
And they know that it's not cool.
Exactly. It's no longer cool to be a Hitler supporter. And still they're very honest about how there's one old man, obviously he's old at the time. He says, Hitler like looked at me and it was as if he was looking straight through me. And he said, I just never anything like that happened in my life. Wow. But basically put the whammy on him. So he's not just a really effective speaker in terms of whipping up the crowd. He's among the vulnerable or the impressionable. He seems to have like this sort of power. People always talk about his eyes.
Yeah. So no wonder
it's really weird.
He's able to build such a strong inner circle.
Yeah. And he has a very devoted following. And very quickly we can talk about his finances later, but he very quickly attracts supporters who are willing to write checks as well. Because, in this environment is really hard. And yet the Nazis very quickly get some financial backing from people who in Bavaria.
Right. Wow.
So
if you can attract, ideologues and money people, you're on the way.
Yeah, you're on the way. You're on the way. Right. So he builds up the Nazi Party in Bavaria. He, by the way, was another myth. He always said that the prestigious thing in the Nazi Party was to have a low membership number, because they were numerically ordered. The lower the number, the means of the earlier you joined the party.
Your
membership
individual
card.
Member. I think
exactly.
Total member.
Right. Okay. Right. Each person had a unique membership number.
Right.
He always claimed that his number was 7. Huh. That's a myth. His number was actually 555.
Oh, right.
It wasn't one. Exactly. No. He essentially hijacked a party that had already been created.
Oh, sorry. Of course.
It was run by this guy named Anton Drexler, mm-hmm. who was basically shunted aside when Hitler rose up. By the way, the consensus in the party was that Hitler should run it.
Okay.
It wasn't like this unpopular coup within the party.
Right. Okay.
He was definitely the popular leader. Everyone realized that the party was growing because of his ability.
Yeah.
But in any case, he lied about his membership number. 555 is still an extremely low number.
Yeah.
You know, by later, you've got numbers in the tens and hundreds of thousands.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people rose up in the party who had very low numbers because they could say, basically, I was a Nazi before it was cool, essentially.
And I was a Nazi before Hitler.
Right.
Which is really
exactly. Although if you knew that to be a fact, you would not announce
it quiet.
That.
Yeah.
You know, it's good for you. Anyway, so in 1923, there's this important point where he leads the beer hall putsch.
Yes. Now, this is a famous event.
It's pretty famous. This is an attempt by the Nazis and what they think are their allies. It's a very complicated event, so we're not going to go into it. But they basically try to seize power in Bavaria. And the idea is you seize power in Bavaria, and then you take the army that's in Bavaria and you march on Berlin.
Right. So this is like seizing the provincial government of
exactly
Bavaria.
Right. And this is led by Hitler. It's a mess. It was going to fail the minute they thought about it. It was very it was put together at the last minute. They didn't take care of a lot of obvious steps. Mm-hmm. If they were serious about this, he's leading a march through Berlin through Munich at one point, towards the Odeon's plots, and they meet a cordon of police. The police and the army are not on board for this coup the way the Nazis wanted them to be. And so basically, a brief gunfight breaks out. Apparently, Hitler comes very close to being shot. The guy next to him is shot like a foot away.
All right.
I think 4 police are killed and about 13 of Hitler's brown shirts, sort of the mm-hmm. stormtroopers, is his muscle. Hermann Göring is wounded in the leg.
All right.
Which is why he becomes a morphine addict. But anyway, so this is the putsch is coup d'etat, the attempted coup d'etat collapses. It's a farce, basically.
Now, why is it called the beer hall push?
It is launched from a beer hall, the Bürgerbräu Keller.
And it is Bavaria, after all, so we should, yeah. Exactly. There must have been one every
street corner. A lot of the big venues for public meetings were beer halls.
Right, because they're
the ones that they could have had a capacity for thousands of people. So a lot of the places like the Zirkus Krone, all these places in Munich where these big meetings were held, and this is where they basically launched the coup.
Okay. Well, if we're going to have taco trucks on every corner in the United States soon, then we can understand that,
exactly.
That these cultural things are very important.
Nice tie-in. In any case, more important than the beer hall putsch itself is what happens afterwards.
Okay.
Because he is put on trial for high treason, as he should have been, because that's what he attempted. He tried to violently seize control of the government. And by the way, in an event in which four policemen lost their lives.
Yeah.
So you could conceivably tack murder charges onto this as well. And here's where you start to see the flaws of the German democracy that was established at the end of World War One, the sort of Weimar Republic, as it's called. Basically, what happened is it was a civilian government established at the end of World War One. It was run by social democrats, sort of moderates and liberals, but they left a lot of the institutions from Imperial Germany in place, like the police, like the army, and like the judiciary.
Okay.
So it's one of the biggest structural flaws about this, what turns out to be a 14-year experiment with democracy.
Okay.
At the time, especially in the mid to late 20s, it looked like it was a great democracy. If you look at the Weimar Constitution, it's a great democratic document. They gave women the right to vote. It was, you know, one man, one vote. It was a terrific democracy.
And they left in these authoritarian legal systems.
Exactly. Basically, the institutions that some of which sometimes you don't even think about that are necessary for democracy to work, they were holdovers from a conservative era under Kaiser Wilhelm.
Yeah.
They had no allegiance to the democracy.
Oh, right.
Yeah. It turns out to be a fatal flaw. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at Hitler's trial, it's a joke. He basically is allowed to turn the trial into his soapbox.
Oh.
One of the judges, and it's not a jury trial, it's a judge trial, it's a panel of judges.
Yeah,
one of the judges is heard during the trial sort of saying in the side when Hitler walked in the room, "Look at this Hitler guy, what a tremendous chap." In other words, the judge is like openly sympathetic to the defendant.
Ugh.
And so, surprise, surprise, he's convicted, sentenced to 5 years, of which he serves 9 months.
Right.
And it's not even like, I mean, it's not, if it were like 9 months busting rocks, you could say, okay, well, that's kind of harsh. No, it was essentially 9 months hard tennis.
Country club prison.
Pretty much. Yeah. He's put in this place called Landsberg, which is, it's not really a prison. It's
hard
a
hotel. Tennis.
Sorry. It's a hotel. Yeah, he's allowed all the visitors he wants.
All right. Okay.
Yeah. There are actually photographs out there of him in prison. And, you know, his buddies are sitting around him. One of them has a guitar. I mean, it's wow, I'm so sorry for you. And it gives him an opportunity to write his incredibly unreadable book, Mein Kampf.
Yes. Wow. Talk about the struggle is getting through it. Yeah.
Right. And once again, another version of the Peter Principle, great success as a speaker, you cannot write his way out of a paper bag.
Yeah.
I've not read all of it, and certainly not in German, but in German it's bad too. And then it gets translated into bad English. But it is important because he's very honest about his goals, which would include, for example, expanding Germany at the expense of its neighbors, especially in the East. And in the 1930s, it would have been nice if people had taken this book seriously.
And been effectively scared and warned by it that this guy's coming up.
Right.
Yeah.
So he gets to write his book. But I was reading Kershaw again, and it's the usual portrayal of the beer hall putsch and the imprisonment is that what Hitler took out of this is that you have to go, you have to try to take power through constitutional means, that a violent attempt on the government is not the way to go. Kershaw sort of modifies that a little bit. He argues that Hitler never really completely abandons the putsch idea. And it actually makes sense if you look at what happens later, because the brown shirts, the sort of the stormtroopers, that continues to grow as an organization. Violence in the streets is a key part of sort of the Nazi strategy for coming to power. Hitler definitely learns to be a little more savvy about how he goes about this, focus more on building sort of nationwide political strength. That's true.
Right.
But the notion that he completely abandoned the idea of a violent takeover, that apparently is not true.
Oh, okay.
Now it turns out he didn't need it. When we talk about how he comes to power, but that's sort of a, we should complicate that a little bit. But maybe we could take this point to talk a little about his personal life.
Yeah, because we've been touching on his personal life all the way through this, his childhood, what he's like in the war, what a comrade he is, mm-hmm. whether he's a good comrade, mm-hmm. and then this magnetism, et cetera, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. So yeah, what was he like, you know, off duty?
Yep. Well, by all accounts, extremely socially awkward, mm-hmm. Especially with women. And I guess before we go any further, because you hear all these things about, like, maybe he was a homosexual, maybe he only had sex with prostitutes. What is the word? Is it monarchism?
Monochronism, or something? Yeah, with one testicle.
Right, right. Know? As as Alan Bullock said once, the one ball thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we have Buzzkill Institute researchers working on that.
Working very hard on that right
diligently
now.
Diligently trying to figure that out.
And that's just scraping the surface. There are a whole series of these myths about his personal life. In almost all cases, there's really no good evidence one way or another.
Right.
Okay. Right. In other words, you can't necessarily 100% exclude the possibility, but for those sorts of claims, you have to have evidence. And a lot of the quote unquote evidence comes from his enemies.
Yeah.
Comes from people who are political opponents, some of them within the Nazi party, mm-hmm. or people during World War II, like allied propagandists,
yeah.
who are trying to belittle him or make him look like a freak.
Yeah.
And so you have to be extremely careful with a lot of this stuff. And a lot of these things, there's absolutely no evidence. He definitely had a very complicated relationship with women.
Yeah.
It's possible he never, ever had sex in his life.
Oh.
He certainly was interested in women and had emotional attachments to certain women, like his half-niece, Geli Raubel. And that's an interesting story.
His half-niece.
So his half-sister's daughter.
Yeah, still very icky.
By 1930, 31, they had a very close emotional relationship. We don't know whether it was actually sexual.
Yeah.
Apart from that, they seem to have been boyfriend and girlfriend.
Hmm.
At a certain point, he started basically to be so controlling that she was basically imprisoned.
And
for example, that either he was in her company or he would have one of his henchmen in her company, like didn't trust her.
Oh, right.
Especially after he found that she was having an affair with his chauffeur, which of course got him fired. Anyway, she kills herself with a handgun in his apartment in Munich.
Yeah, yeah.
And they, of course, quickly hushed that up.
Yeah. And this is not very well known in the general history.
Yeah, actually, somebody recently wrote a book about her. And yeah, there's not a lot of evidence. We've moved on from his early life. But from his early life, a lot of the evidence is very sketchy.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of it comes from Mein Kampf, which you can't rely on.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he was not an important person, so there's wasn't a lot.
And not in an important family.
Exactly.
So
there was no record of his early life. Through the end of his life, he likes to surround himself with women who he doesn't have sort of a close relationship with, but who mm-hmm. sort of mother him.
Mm.
Often, like women who are married to other men.
Oh, really?
Like Joseph Goebbels's wife, Magda.
Right.
Other women like that in other words, he finds women who like to mother him because he likes to be mothered by them. But he's always, by all accounts, super polite and even charming. On a personal level, especially with women.
Wow.
You know, not at all. A lot of women reported being shocked by, you know, they'd like see him give a speech.
Yeah.
Where he just seems like a psychopath.
Yeah, yeah.
And then
they
meet him personally and he's funny and charming and witty. And they're like, wow, it's like two different people. So there are all these myths out there about his sex life. Early in the 20s, he surrounds himself with people like Heinrich Hoffmann, who's his official photographer.
Right.
Extremely, I would say, obsessed with sort of creating and managing his image.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see this, you know, if you go online, there are, I'm sure, thousands, if not tens of thousands of photographs mm-hmm. of Adolf Hitler. You will find extremely few that show him wearing his glasses.
Oh, right.
There are a few, especially from World War II. But by World War II, his people around him actually had these things called a Führer typewriter. It was basically a typewriter that typed in like an 18-point font.
Oh, right. So he could read it.
He could read it without his glasses, like in a speech, right? And so in other words, a really thick speech is because there's so few words on each page.
Oh, my goodness, man.
But I've seen maybe three photos in my entire life with him wearing his glasses. The other thing you're not going to see, with a couple of exceptions, are pictures of him showing his teeth.
Of course, Wilson's the same way. Woodrow Wilson was the same way because...
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's an important point. It's not like Hitler's the only person managing his image.
Yeah,
he was particularly keen on managing it. Constantly was sort of trying out different outfits in front of the camera to see what works. But his teeth were horrible.
Hmm.
And in the few photos out there that I've seen where you actually see his teeth, you can tell they're horrible.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because he was had an unbelievable sweet tooth. Constantly eating sugary goodies in great quantities, and it just sort of destroyed his teeth.
Yeah, as well.
So he's sort of the dentist's poster child. He is constantly getting dental work done and never shows his teeth in photographs. But there's also this in this period, one of the image making of Hitler is that he's sort of an ascetic.
Oh, that he wants to deny.
Exactly.
Not denying candy.
No. Well, also not publicly showing his weaknesses.
I see. Okay.
He gets, and they sort of create an image that he is not interested in sort of comfort or privilege or luxury. The idea is that he's, and it's all of a piece with the same thing that when he does actually have girlfriends, they keep them out of the public light.
Mm.
Like Eva Braun, who's his girlfriend for years.
Yeah,
through the end of his life, they keep her on the down low. She never appears in public with him.
Right.
And it's a similar idea, which is he allegedly doesn't enjoy luxuries or have a nice life because he's essentially married to the German people.
Right, right. And all his energy
goes into leading Germany to greatness,
right,
and to striking back at Germany's enemies and giving Germany its place in the sun. That's a phrase from the imperial period, but it's the same basic idea.
Yeah.
And, that he doesn't have time for a nice personal life. And, and to the extent that he had a sort of a public persona, there was evidence of this. For example, he was a vegetarian. That was true.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't smoke and he didn't drink at a time when
everybody smoked and drank a lot.
And so that feeds in this idea that he's sort of has this sort of very plain, simple lifestyle and doesn't indulge in anything. It's actually – now, by the way, the fact that he didn't smoke is interesting too, because there's a war book out there by, I think, Robert Proctor called The Nazi War on Cancer.
Mm-hmm.
The Nazis were actually way ahead of their time in establishing a link between tobacco use and cancer.
Oh, did that research sort of get lost after the war?
I haven't actually read the book. I think so. And of course, any Nazi science is – quite properly held, it's questionable and held in suspicion, but they were, and I get the impression it's partly because Hitler himself was anti-smoking, and like people were not allowed to smoke in his presence, even sort of chain smokers.
Now, does anybody know, is that because he just literally hated the smell, or he thought of it as a filthy habit?
I think he hated the smell.
Okay,
with a lot of non-smokers, if you smoke, you're not bothered by cigarette smoke, but other people are. But anyway, this is pretty much a myth. The myth of the sort of the Hitler as the ascetic. He had a really nice life even before he was chancellor. Of course, it becomes much nicer after he becomes chancellor.
Sure.
But for example, he was really into very fast and very expensive cars, even though he didn't drive.
Hmm.
He always had a chauffeur. In fact, he didn't know how to drive. But he would he loved these big, at the time, super expensive, like Mercedes convertibles. And he would sit up front next to the driver, top down, tear-assing down the road at really high speeds. Yeah. He loved that. He had a very comfortable life from pretty early on in his political career. Like I said, he had sort of, if I can use the term, sugar daddies. He had people who were sort of supporting him behind the scenes.
Right, right.
Once the Nazi Party breaks through in voting in sort of parliamentary elections in 1930, after that he starts to rake in a lot of money from Mein Kampf.
Okay, okay.
His book Mein Kampf, as terrible as it is, especially after he becomes chancellor, is a mega bestseller throughout his life, and it's a huge source of income.
And he's not giving that money to the poor. He's using it. He's not living like a monk. He's using it to feather his nest.
Yes. Okay. He's got, you know, before too long, he's got his, he's at first he rents, but then he builds in the Bavarian Alps outside the town of Berchtesgaden. It's called the Berghof. That's what his house
is.
Once he becomes chancellor, the money really starts to roll in. I just found this out recently. He and a lot of other top Nazis, once they're in power, he declares himself tax exempt. So he doesn't pay any income tax on his on his rather sizable income, which of course makes him even richer. Another source of his income after he's chancellor is he gets a royalty for every postage stamp that has his likeness on it.
From the German post office?
From the German post office. And if you look at
all the pictures
of all these stamps online, obviously Germans used mail like everybody else through World War II. The basic Nazi postage stamp has Hitler's face on it. And it's the kind of thing, it's like, even if you're getting a tiny royalty, are so many postage stamps. And tax-free. So, you know, his villa up in the Bavarian Alps, his other residences, the Reich Chancellery they build in Berlin at the end of the 1930s, these are all palatial places. He had, like I said, very sort of traditional 19th century art tastes, but he collected a lot of art. He had personal representatives scouring Europe, buying up art. So he had a really nice life. He had a ton of servants.
Yeah.
You know, he watched, you know, the latest Hollywood films flown to his place so he could watch them late at night. He was a huge film buff. So the idea that he's an ascetic was really a load of crap.
Well,
it was all public relations.
Also, and with the Depression coming on, the one person who is stabbing the German people in the back financially and economically and tax-wise is Hitler.
Yep, yeah. often overlooked.
Ripping them off.
Yeah, and not just him. It was systemic. One of the things that's overlooked about, I think, about the Third Reich is just how much corruption there was.
Because sort of old school corruption.
Exactly. Yeah, and it is true. I mean, people at the time knew about some of his henchmen like Hermann Göring, who really was a fat cat and lived very ostentatiously. I mean, he lived sort of like a Gilded Age robber baron with all his big palaces and his hunting trips and his fur coats and his, you know, diamond rings and stuff.
Cigarette cases.
Yeah. And so, and actually in a way I would argue that sort of helps Hitler out. Cause by comparison, Hitler looks like an ascetic.
Yeah.
But keep in mind that when the Nazis come to power in 1933, they superimpose on the existing sort of administrative structure, this party structure. They break Germany into these, they're not provinces. They're called Gaus. And you have Gauleiter, the Nazi party sort of poobahs that are in charge of each of these places. All these people chosen for their loyalty and for the length of time they'd been in the Nazi party.
Their Nazi party number.
Pretty much.
Membership number.
And so very few of them are competent. A lot of them are super corrupt. They're some of the most venal people you've ever seen in European history. And they've risen to the top because they latched on to Adolf Hitler and sort of rode him to the top. And a lot of them are skimming local resources, not paying taxes, living very high off the hog. And there's actually, at the time, even there's a resentment of some of these people.
Yeah, okay. So again, the stab in the back is now happening.
And you saw this, for example, in Tsarist Russia.
Right.
Where these stories about sort of Nazi corruption were quite common. And the reaction of a lot of people was, oh, wow, if only Hitler knew. In other words, people divide sort of in their minds, they divide the great leader from all the people who work from him.
Yeah.
You know, like in Tsarist Russia, it's like, oh, if only the Tsar knew.
Only we could get to him and tell him.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
You know what? Tsar kind of set this whole thing up. Hate to break it to you. It's not a bug. It's a feature.
Well, it's amazing how the various populists can be delusional.
Absolutely right. So anyway, he does have this personal life, which is very much at odds with the public image. You know, he only, like I said, with women, he only marries Eva Braun in the other bunker. At the very end, and then they essentially, their honeymoon is them killing themselves. And that's partly because part of his attraction to the German public is the way women react to him and even the way women fantasize about him. And that's another reason to keep his sort of girlfriend behind the scenes, because they want to sort of play to this idea that he's the leader who's sort of beyond personal relationships and beyond sort of human desires.
Right.
That's all part of the image building.
So what? What then happens after the stock market crash and the depression starts in the 30s? He's still a Bavarian leader, but he's not yet a national leader.
Right. In fact, and the Great Depression, once again, really hard to exaggerate its importance because look at the Nazi Party circa 1928. It's a joke. Mm-hmm. The Weimar democracy is at its sort of best years. German economy has recovered from World War I and from the post-war hyperinflation that helped lead to things like the Bierhalbputsch in 1923. And it's very stable. This sort of centrist, pro-small-d democratic parties are very much in charge and very popular. Nazi Party has a national presence, but it's getting something like 2 or 3% of the vote in parliamentary elections. Okay. So it's like it's not even taken seriously by anybody.
Now, we should remind the buzzkillers, this is a parliamentary system, so it's all about how many party votes you get and
shows another
up in the major legislature.
Exactly. And that is another design flaw because it's purely proportional.
Right.
If you get 1% of the vote, you get 1% of the seats.
Yeah.
If you get 1/100% of the votes, you get 100%. Yeah. And so you end up with this fracturing and all these micro parties.
And a lot of nutters.
And a lot of nutters and a lot of regional parties or sort of one issue parties. Mm-hmm. And by the way, you've seen this in some post-war democracies. You see this in places like Belgium and Italy.
Yeah. Oh, Italy was famous.
Italy, which has like more than a government per year after 1945 on average.
12 party coalitions.
Israel also.
Yeah. Yeah.
And by the way, the Germans learned from this. Post-war West Germany and then to Germany today, they have a 5% rule.
Yeah.
If you don't have 5%, at least 5%, you get no seats. And that was a deliberate, that's them trying to learn from history. In any case, stock market crashes, Great Depression hits Germany, by the way, even harder than the United States.
Oh, right. Okay.
They have higher unemployment. It really is a disaster, an economic disaster of a type that Germany had never seen. And it is directly responsible for the rise of the Nazi Party. There are parliamentary elections in September 1930.
Okay.
Now,
the dates are important. The dates are important here because we're getting closer and closer to the big election, so to speak.
That's right.
So 1930, there's an election.
And keep in mind that in a parliamentary system, you have irregular elections. You can have new elections. You can have parliament is dissolved. Reichstag is dissolved and you call new elections.
Yep.
And in September 1930, the Nazis do very, very well, pretty much out of nowhere. They end up with 107 seats out of, I want to say 500 and some. I think they get they get like 18% of the vote.
For a still regional party, that's pretty good.
Yeah, or a largely regional party, but also a party that really hasn't changed. It hasn't changed its message. That video I mentioned that Nazis are warning from history, they mentioned this town in East Prussia called Neidenburg, where in 1928 the Nazi party got something like 2.8% of the vote. In the 1930 elections in the same town, they got over 25% of the vote. And I think they single it out because this is a town where there was no Nazi Party organization. Mm-hmm. Hitler didn't visit. Mm. And all of a sudden, people are pulling the lever for the Nazis in much larger numbers. Mm. And so the video argues correctly, in my view, that what's changed is people's willingness to hear the message. The message itself hasn't changed.
Because presumably it's being broadcast enough in radio and newspapers that they can get it in other regions.
In the largest sense, what's happening is people blame the democracy for the economic misery.
Right.
There was no, German democracy was flawed and very young. There was no democratic political culture in Germany going way, way back. So the first sign of serious trouble, which you have by 1930, people start to abandon the democracy. They abandon the center for the extremes of both left and right. Votes for the German Communist Party also go way up.
Oh, right.
And so basically war is being waged on this democracy from the left and right extremes. And this is where Hitler really gets noticed. The party builds and builds its strength, right? They have broad appeal. They get a lot of middle class, a lot of people whose livelihoods have been destroyed by the 1920s hyperinflation. They get a lot of working class. They get a lot of World War I veterans, not surprisingly. The fact that he was not a general but a corporal actually works for him.
Oh, right. Because he wasn't part of that stab in the back system.
Right. He's not an elitist. He's not a Prussian Junker with his big estate. He's the kind of guy you could have a beer with, right?
In a beer hall, exactly.
You can just share the bench with him. He's like us, right? I was a grunt in the front line just like him, so he sort of gets me. Mm-hmm. And It's also important to point out that in this period, like 30 to 33, the anti-Semitism is not a central part of the Nazis' appeal. You can find it if you look for it. If you if you read any newspapers or read up on Hitler or, you know, sort of followed him, you knew it and had no excuse not to know it.
Yeah.
But if you look at your typical Nazi campaign posters, and of course that's how the way you advertised back then was posters.
Absolutely, yeah.
They're all about things like work and bread.
Mm-hmm.
Or do away with this system that made you miserable. There's one famous poster that all it is, it just has it's the sort of very drably colored drawing of sort of a massive unemployed people sort of looking at you. And the only thing it says on the poster is our last hope, Hitler. There's not even a swastika on the poster.
Right.
It's, in other words, they almost like sort of, in a way, they kind of denazify him.
Hmm.
And basically say, if you want a job, if you want bread on the table, vote for Hitler. He'll save you. He's like he's essentially the man on horseback who will destroy this ridiculous, worthless democracy. All you got to do is follow him and he'll take care of you.
So they are, the Nazis are in effect following or trimming their sails to meet the economic reality of the time. They realize are going to vote with their wallets and therefore we're going to see them as the back to work party.
And that's why I think sort of if you counterfactually remove the Great Depression, it's really hard to imagine the Nazis coming to power.
Okay. Okay.
So fast forward to 1932 when they actually have two national elections in 1 year.
Right, right.
And by this point, by the way, it's another important to understand the flaw in this system is it's a parliamentary system. Chief executive is the Reichskanzler, sort of the prime minister, the chancellor. But there's also a president who's elected separately to 7-year terms and who's not a figurehead, who normally would be a figurehead in most parliamentary systems.
Right, right.
Right. In a place like Israel or post-war Germany, right, you have a president who is essentially like our vice president, sort of a ceremonial post.
Yeah. And only exercise power in like extreme circumstances.
Right. Now, in this case, it's built into the Weimar Constitution that when you don't have a parliamentary majority, in other words, you can't form an actual majority of a party or parties in the Reichstag.
Right.
The chancellor can rule by decree by power given to him by the president.
Oh, I see.
In other words, all of a sudden the president becomes really important.
Right, okay.
And the president after 1925 is Paul von Hindenburg, who was basically the military dictator of, in effect, Imperial Germany during World War I.
Right,
Ludendorff, an early pal of Hitler's actually, they had basically run the German war effort during World War I. By this point, and once again, it's all about, you know, he's the president of a democracy and he doesn't believe in democracy. He's a crusty old conservative who has no time for democracy. He thinks it's a mess.
Yep.
And he's the president now, so all of a sudden he's a really important guy and he really doesn't believe in preserving this democracy.
Oh.
So, and then you have a couple of elections in 1932 where the Nazis do even better. Well, then the first one, in the summer of 1932, they win 37% of the vote and become the largest party in the Reichstag.
Right.
And that's important because that's one of the reasons.
Remember, there are more than two parties in the situation.
There are probably a dozen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So 37% is a hell of a lot.
Yes, absolutely. Right. In a system that fractured, it's a huge deal. It's over a third of the vote. So they don't have a majority, but they are the largest single party.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all these layers here. Hitler also runs against Hindenburg for the presidency in 1932 and loses.
Huh.
And of course, the sort of the moderate and liberal parties rally behind Hindenburg because the alternative is Hitler, which of course is horrifying. But these are people voting for Hindenburg; they would never vote for him otherwise, right?
That's
He's an arch conservative. He believes in sort of authoritarian rule
and a blast from the past.
He's in his 80s.
Yeah.
You know, he's not. He's sort of starting to become sort of doddering.
Mm-hmm. Still a fantastic mustache. You have to admit.
Big mustache, no question. But, and then at the end of 1932, anyway, so that presidential campaign, even though Hitler loses it, he sort of establishes his bona fides as sort of a legitimate candidate to a lot of people.
Okay.
And I think that happens in the spring of 32. And I think that helps boost his vote in the parliamentary elections in the summer of 32.
So he's not coming from nowhere. There's this kind of, I guess it's
not
a myth, but the way I was taught that he sort of came out of nowhere, the Bavarian party, he just used regionalism stuff.
No, they have pockets of strength all across Germany, including in the north. You know, and you can find Prussians who look down at him and hear in his accent and basically think here's this rube from Austria.
Sure.
It's like, I'd never vote for him. They look at the funny mustache and the gravelly voice. And they're like, this guy's a goofball.
Yeah.
A lot of people underestimate him for that.
Yeah, sure.
Including the people who are going to try to try to appoint him and manipulate him. But at the end of 1932, they have another set of parliamentary elections where the Nazis do a little bit worse.
Oh.
They lose seats.
Hmm.
And that's really important because a couple months later, he's appointed chancellor.
How does that happen?
Well, when you don't have a majority,
yeah,
the president is authorized to name a chancellor. Right? Because remember, right, there's right, not, right. And, yeah, yeah, yeah. And that situation, the president can appoint whomever he wants.
Right.
Hitler tried to become appointed chancellor the previous summer, like in August 1932, and Hindenburg basically said no.
Yeah.
Like essentially over my dead body.
Yep.
Like this, you know, this once again, this bohemian corporal is like, no way am I gonna make him. He's too uncouth.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like the chaos being sown in the streets by Nazi stormtroopers. And by the way, that's one of the very cynical ploys the Nazis do in this period, is they create all this havoc and they say, vote for us, put an end to all the havoc.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, doesn't get any more cynical than that. But December 1932, January 1933, all these people around Hindenburg, arch conservatives, including former chancellor Franz von Papen.
Yeah.
None of them are small D Democrats. They want to reestablish authoritarian rule. They start leaning on Hindenburg to appoint Hitler chancellor.
Is this the idea that they can appoint him chancellor and get him out of the way, so to speak, or control him?
Control him from behind the scenes. This is an epic, obviously epic misunderstanding, sort of misconception. A lot of these people, they underestimate Hitler. They figured we got to bring him into the government because his party's still getting the most votes.
Yeah.
But if you compare the two elections, the Nazis have peaked. They're on the downslope.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's a reason why we can sort of bring him into the government, but control him. These are all people, including Hindenburg's son, includes a couple other people who are sort of working on Hindenburg, this old man, to get him to cave in to appoint Hitler chancellor.
Yeah, yeah.
None of them have any idea what they're dealing with. They really don't. And so at the end of January 1933, Hindenburg appoints Hitler chancellor. And it's amazing, even today, how many people say, on the one hand, A, Hitler was elected chancellor. Not true.
There's a big myth.
Or in Germany today, you still see the phrase, die Machtergreifung, seizure of power.
Okay.
Also not really true. Unless you're talking about the post-January 1933 period when he establishes a dictatorship and definitively destroys German democracy.
Yeah, chancellor.
But he's already chancellor. And he can do that because he's been made chancellor legitimately. Appointment of Hitler's chancellor by Hindenburg, that was by the book. That was in accordance with the Weimar Constitution.
Okay. Well, that's certainly not what I was taught. All the way through college, I was taught.
It's amazing. Yeah, no, I mean, and so you see these sort of extreme misconceptions on the one hand that he was the most popular choice of the German people and they voted him in, not true. And the idea that he seized power, also not true. He was
right.
And by the way, the people like von Papen who are like sort of orchestrating this from behind the scenes, there's a 9-person ruling cabinet. The Nazis only get 3 posts, including chancellor.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it also includes Minister of the Interior, who controls the police.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's where immediately this starts to go south for German democracy, because within a month, the Nazis probably certainly take advantage of the Reichstag fire.
Right.
Parliament building burns to the ground. They pin it on the communists.
The Nazis pinned it on the
communists. Sorry, the Nazis pinned it on the communists. They basically say, look, we've been complaining about what a sort of mortal threat to our country the communists are.
Yeah.
And here's proof.
Look what they did.
Exhibit A, look, they destroyed the very symbol of German democracy. Of course, it's from what I've seen, it's pretty clear that the Nazis set the fire.
Yeah, yeah.
And at the end of the day, it's really not important who set the fire. It's
what
they did with it. So immediately they start pairing stormtroopers with police.
Oh.
Because you control the Ministry of the Interior.
You can do that.
And they start to lock up their extreme enemies like the communists.
Mm-hmm.
They have another parliamentary election early March 1933. Which is not really a fair election or free election. There's lots of intimidation. Stormtroopers are standing outside the polling places. Lots of leading communists and social democrats are already in jail.
Yeah.
The Nazis still don't win an outright majority, by the way, in that election.
Yeah.
They win seats. Together with their conservative allies, they are allowed, they put through what's called the Enabling Act.
Yeah.
Which allows the chancellor to pass laws without a majority in the Reichstag.
Oh.
That's the decisive step. That allows Hitler then to basically start destroying German democracy
and
piece by piece.
And become a dictator.
And become a dictatorship. Yep.
So exactly what Hindenburg was trying to do, and exactly what the sort of establishment German parties were trying to do, is bringing him in and so they could control him.
Control him. And that, now
the exact opposite happened.
Exactly.
Because and now he's saying he can do this these orders by fiat.
Right.
Therefore, he can control everybody
and
else.
And within 6 months, they've outlawed all other political parties, including the conservatives, like the German, DNVP, the German National People's Party. And a lot of these people, they're just like, well, what happened? A lot of these people are going to end up dead in the Night of the Long Knives, even though the conservatives.
Sure, yeah.
Some of them are going to have to flee.
Right.
Pretty soon Hitler is outlawing labor unions, nationalizing all sources of information, including newspaper and radio.
Wow.
A lot of people have to, like I said, flee to other countries for their lives. They set up the first concentration camps, which are not for Jews. They're for political opponents.
Right.
Sometimes they're very small, but people are tortured. A few people are shot, quote unquote, while trying to escape. They start to rely on terror.
Mm-hmm.
And within 18 months, so by the end of summer 1934, Hindenburg is dead and German democracy is a faint memory and Hitler has concentrated all power in his hands.
Wow. And I know that for the rest of the 30s, all the way up to the war, there are hundreds of myths and big and small we can bust, but let's take that up in episode two. In an episode two. You can come back, I presume, a little bit later.
Oh, absolutely.
But it's amazing to me how... Not only does he have this very, very strange youth, it's very strange in a number of ways at how quickly he's able to come to power. Lots of people have to screw up or be asleep at the wheel or think, oh, it'll be okay. He'll calm down when he has to deal with a full cabinet and all that kind of stuff.
And if you look at what he was up against, some of these career politicians, some of the very clever people, and yet he beats every single one of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, Buzzkillers, join us next time. Because when Professor Nash comes back, we're going to talk about the rise of Nazi Germany and the rise of Hitler's dictatorship in the 30s. Talk to you then.